Last, his father whistled and leaned back in his chair.
"I don't like it,"
Penny opined. Matthew protested.
"We have to help her. I won't leave her like that."
His mother smiled in sympathy.
"I didn't mean you should. I just said I don't like it. I hate the thought of either of you going into such a dangerous place."
"If we do it right, it won't be dangerous at all," insisted Matthew.
"You really care about her, don't you?"
said Penny.
"Mom, please. It isn't anything like that. She's a friend. I can't abandon her."
"Of course not," she answered, looking at her husband. Mordecai nodded.
"It's just a question of figuring out the safest way to extract her. You said she had lost a lot of blood?"
They spent another quarter of an hour going over Karen's condition, but decided to put off the planning for later so Matthew could take a much-needed bath. He didn't argue the point. Later in his room, Gary spoke up.
"I noticed you didn't say very much about me."
"Dad didn't seem like he was going to trust you," said Matthew.
"You made it sound like I'm a toy you turn off and stick in your bag most of the time. You didn't even tell them I was there. I could have contributed to the conversation," said the AGI.
"Would you like to go in my bag?" offered the young wizard. "It can be arranged."
The machine started to reply, but Matthew shushed him.
"My sister's coming. Stay quiet."
The knock on his door was just a courtesy. She opened it immediately after.
"Hi."
He didn't feel like talking, but something in her eyes stopped him from telling her to go away. She looked haunted, and her face seemed almost gaunt. Gone was her native enthusiasm and vitality, replaced by a tired young woman who seemed world-weary beyond her years. Matthew tried to be sympathetic.
"You look like shit."
Her eyes lit with a flash of anger, but it disappeared almost instantly, replaced by relief.
"I guess some things never change, do they? What happened to you? I haven't heard the whole story yet," he asked, mildly surprised by his own interest. "A little of this and a little of that," she answered. "Do we have to talk about it?"
"No," he said, mentally. But he was surprised when he found a shield around her mind so dense that he doubted she could even hear his thought.
"Don't," she said quietly. "It isn't good for me to talk that way, not in close proximity at least."
He arched one brow.
"Not good. Is there something you should tell me about?" "Again, not something I want to talk about," she said. "Just make sure you keep your mental shields tightly closed when I'm around. All right?"
Now he was really curious, but after a moment he nodded.
"Fine."
They sat in silence for almost a full minute before she spoke again.
"I heard about Desiccus. I'm sorry."
"Yeah," he answered dully.
"And that you met a girl," she added, her tone rising slightly. "Of course," he thought silently. "That's what brought her in here."
"It isn't like that."
"She isn't a girl?"
Matthew sighed.
"You know what I mean?"
"Well, of course," she replied.
"Everyone knew there was no chance of that."
"Very funny.
Did you see Graham when you got here?"
she asked suddenly.
"Yeah, he ran interference from me on my way up here," said Matt.
"Why?"
"Just wanted to know how he was doing. I haven't seen him in a while. Alyssa's back, did you know?"
"He told me," he answered. But Matthew was mulling over her words as he did.
"Why haven't you seen him?" "I've been staying here most of the time, resting up. I haven't been out but once or twice since I got back."
Moira's voice was dry, matter of fact.
"Nothing to see here," thought Matthew. "That's what she's trying to say, but there's definitely something. Did you get in trouble with Mom and Dad?"
"They were worried," she replied.
"It was about the same when I got back, except I wasn't lucky and had to face everyone in the castle yard. But I'm not being punished. I just haven't felt like seeing people."
"Yeah, sure," he thought. Myra liked seeing people the same way a fish liked water. She wouldn't stay in for a week by choice.
"I heard you started a war."
Myra didn't answer, so they sat in silence for a few minutes. It was a reassuring quiet, a peaceful space without expectation. Neither of them felt like fighting, and to say more would have probably led to an argument. So instead they left the words for later. After a while she rose and headed for the door.
"I'm glad you made it back in one piece," she said, without looking back.
"You too,"
he said quietly. And then she was gone. With one hand he flipped the PM over so the screen was facing up again. It lit up immediately.
"Great talk with your sister," said Gary dryly.
Actually, Matthew agreed.
Something was wrong with her, of that he was sure, and it worried him slightly. But overall, he was just glad she had been more subdued.
"It's more about what we don't say," he observed.
Chapter 30 The next 2 days were busy. Matthew was inundated with friends and family that wanted to know where he had been. The questions were innumerable. Connell and Irene pestered him endlessly, though not just about him. They also probed him about Moira. It wasn't just Graham that had seen little of Moira. It was pretty much everyone. Since her return, she had been to Dunbar once, and on a short trip with Mordecai. Other than that, she had stayed in her room and kept to herself. The annoying part was that, for some reason, everyone seemed to think that Matthew would have some sort of intuition or mystical way to fix his sister.
"I know less than they do, though," he noted silently.
He didn't really have time to spend trying to figure it out, either. More pressing was the need to save Karen. He had already questioned Linarala on the matter, and, as he had suspected, she knew nothing of the Shi'ar's advanced healing methods. She suggested asking her mother, which would require a journey and a lot of time, since she was a mature Shi'ar. Because of that, they ruled that option out, and sent a message to Gareth Galen in Albemarle. He was kind enough to respond to the urgency of the request, and arrived in Castle Cameron the morning of Matthew's 3rd day back. Matthew and his father greeted him in the entry hall of the castle keep.
"Gareth," said Mordecai, "it's good to see you again."
Bush-red brows drew together in a sceptical expression.
"Really, Mort? Is it that good to see me?"
"Well, of course," said the Count, giving their guest his most disarming smile.
"My wife has been in a foul mood since she returned from her last visit, but she refuses to discuss the matter," stated Gareth, cutting straight to the point.
"Why don't we talk about that?"
Mort frowned.
"Let's find someplace private."
Matthew watched the whole exchange without saying anything, but his own curiosity was piqued now. Gareth shook his hand, and the three of them started walking. Once they were safely ensconced in a private room, this time in the Cameron family apartments, not their home in the mountains, they began their discussion.
"Moira wouldn't tell me why she was so insistent on her visit when she left, and she's been unsettled ever since she returned," said Gareth. "What did you do?"
He made no attempt to disguise the accusatory tone in his voice. He was referring to his wife, Moira Sentier, not Matthew's sister, the inheritor of her name. Matthew watched his father's face. Mordecai's gaze remained steady, his eyes on Gareth and his expression revealing nothing. But it was clear the gears were working behind his still features. Eventually he spoke.
"Your wife came to check on my daughter."
"That's not unusual," replied Gareth. "Get to the point."
The tension in the air was growing, but Matthew couldn't help but agree.
"Yeah, what happened?"
"As you surmise, it wasn't a casual visit. She was concerned about the events in Dunbar and Moira's part in them. The Sentier have many secrets, and she was worried that our daughter had broken some of their hidden rules." "You knew the Sentier back when they were thriving," added the Count. "Are you familiar with any of their internal laws?"
Gareth had relaxed once Mort started talking.
"Not really. They kept to themselves for the most part. They even raised their children in seclusion, so most of us from the other families only interacted with them in the council. Did she break any of those rules you mentioned?"
Matthew saw the hesitation on his father's face as he considered his answer.
"He's thinking about lying. Why?"
Mordecai let out a sigh of resignation.
"Yes, she did."
The other archmage winced visibly.
"And you bound my wife, didn't you?"
Matt knew he had missed something, but he held his tongue.
"I had no other choice," admitted the Count. "She has too much power for me to have done anything else."
Moira Sentier was an artificial being, a spell clone of the original Moira, and after Mordecai's battles to dispose of the Shining Gods,
he'd had to find places to store the power he had taken from them. Most of it had gone into the dragons that he and Gareth had created, but a significant portion had been stored in Moira Sentir. Consequently, she had as much strength in her as one of the Shining Gods. But Mordecai knew the key that controlled the enchantment that preserved her, and it could be used to compel absolute obedience.
"She wanted to kill the girl?"
asked Gareth, seeking confirmation. Mort nodded his affirmation. It was too much for Matthew, though.
"What?"
he blurted out.
"Why? Moira's her daughter."
Gareth rubbed his beard in agitation.
"I don't know the why, but back in my day it wasn't uncommon. Once in a while the Sentir would eliminate one of their own. More often than not it was one of their younger mages, though sometimes it would be one of the older, more accomplished members of the clan. They never admitted to it, of course, but we knew. One of them would go missing, and they'd refuse to speak of them again."
"And everyone was fine with that?" said Matthew in disbelief. "The families didn't interfere with one another," said Gareth stiffly. "What they did to their own was none of our business." Mordecai spoke again.
"I hope you can forgive me, Gareth, but with my daughter's life at stake, I didn't see any other choice."
"I'm not happy," said Gareth honestly.
"What did the girl do?"
"Your wife didn't want me to reveal their secrets, so..." began Mort.
Gareth snapped.
"God damn it, man! I don't give two shits about their rules, and neither do you. You've bound my wife's free will in this matter, so I will hear the cause for it."
Matthew felt the older man's words like a slap and leaned back involuntarily. He'd never heard anyone speak to his father in a tone like that. Mordecai stayed calm and then sighed.
"She used her power to control and manipulate the people around her. She did it in self-defense, mainly, or with good intentions, but it's caused a shift in her personality and unlocked some troublesome abilities."
Now Matthew began to understand. He also had Tyrion's memories, and he remembered the damage the Sentir Shihar had represented to him ages ago. "That was why she didn't want to make mental contact when she was in my room," he realized. It was also the likely reason for her self-imposed isolation.
"I don't know the particulars of how something like that affects them," admitted Gareth. "But I would imagine the Sentir don't kill their own unless they have a damn good reason. Do you think you know better than they did?"
The Count nodded.
"I know something of it, from the memories in the Loshti, but not much. But I also heard what your wife had to say on the matter."
"And what did she say?" asked Gareth. "Since she can no longer speak of it on her own."
There was anger in his voice.
"She felt that Moira would be tempted to abuse her power in the future, that it had tainted her spirit," said Mordecai.
"Don't sugarcoat it, Mordecai," rebuked Gareth. "She wouldn't insist on death if she thought she would be tempted. She had to have believed it was worse than that."
"Fine. She believed my daughter had become a reaver. It was her term for a Sentir mage that has been corrupted, allowing their power to twist them into some sort of inhuman monster. Is that what you want me to say?"
said Mordecai in frustration.
"I think she's wrong."
"You would," said Gareth. "You're an optimistic fool. My wife knows the Sentir, and she knows her daughter. You should have followed her advice."
The chair Mordecai was sitting on rippled for an instant, so briefly that Matthew almost thought he had imagined it. He felt nothing. His father's emotions were well hidden behind a shield that had become as solid as stone. But he had seen it.
"He's angry," thought Matt. "So angry that he lost control for a moment."
He glanced at Gareth for a second, noting that the other archmage was also hiding his feelings behind a tightly made shield.
"This could get ugly."
The Count's voice was cool and level when he replied,
"I disagree, and unless I see evidence to make me think otherwise, that's the end of it."
Gareth Galen's eyes flashed fire, and he stood.
"Then we have nothing more to discuss. Don't bother asking me for help or advice either. You are no longer welcome in my home, and I'll thank you to keep your daughter away as well."
He started to turn away.
"Wait!"
exclaimed Matthew, drawing looks from both men.
"I need your help."
"You heard me, mageling," said Gareth, dismissing him. "If your father won't see reason, I'm done here."
"Let him go, Matt,"
advised his father.
We can do it without him.
Matt turned to face Mordecai. You said he was the best for this. I'm not going to risk Karen's life to satisfy your pride. Gareth chuckled. Your whelp has grown teeth, Mordecai. Let me speak to Gareth alone, said Matt, entreating his father. The Count's eyes ranged between them, flashing with anger. When they landed on Matthew, he saw something else for a moment, but it vanished in an instant, washed away by his father's wrath.
Very well, son. Talk to him if you wish, but I'll have nothing to do with it if he's involved. If you want to act like a man and make your own deals, then you'll have to accept the consequences as well. I'm done with this.
He left the room with a heavy stride, and when he reached the door it flew open with such force that the wood splintered. It slammed shut behind him with a thundering boom.
Lord Galen, began Matthew, after the air had settled. Just Gareth, young Elenil, said the red-bearded wizard. I need no titles when talking to men, even foolish ones. I hope the trouble between you and my father won't sway you before you hear my—
Don't bandy words, young man, barked Gareth. You threw your father's pride in his face, and now you want to speak to me with soft phrases? Talk plainly, and don't bother using sugared words for my ears.
Matthew spoke earnestly. There's a woman, in another world. She's badly wounded. I left her in stasis, but she will surely die shortly after emerging from it, unless I can persuade you to help her.
Not my problem, said Gareth curtly.
But she'll die of young man. I ate my friends and spent 1,000 years living as a dragon. Why should I care if some stranger from another world dies? And you might as well have spit on your father just now. Why should I help a fool?
Matthew was thinking furiously, trying to come up with something. Finally, he said,
Even if you consider my father your enemy, I am not. In the future, I could be a powerful ally.
The Archmage held up a hand to forestall any more.
I would not call your father an enemy, though he certainly is not my friend. I owe him much for his help in the past, or I would have tried to slay him for his insult to my wife. You do realize our disagreement is over your sister's life, don't you? Would you ask for aid from a man who might desire her execution?
Matthew sat straighter and squared his shoulders.
That matter is not for me to decide. If it should lead to a fight between you, I will defend her and the rest of my family. But it was not me who offended you, and it was no fault of my friends either. Karen nearly died trying to help me and my dragon, though she hardly knew us.
Help her, please,
Gareth snorted.
She probably considered your dragon nothing more than a mount or fancy pet.
No,
he protested.
They were friends. I wonder what Desiccus would say if we ask him that same question,
said Gareth derisively.
He's dead, snapped Matthew. He died, trying to protect us.
The red-bearded mage's eyes widened.
Dead.
Dead,
he affirmed.
I was knocked unconscious at the same time.
And the egg?
Taken.
Gareth Galen stood, looking down at the young wizard.
And what do you propose to do about that?
Matthew stood as well. He was not as tall as Gareth, but he wouldn't let that intimidate him. Giving the Archmage an even stare, he answered,
I'm going to take it back, and make sure that the ones who did it never make that mistake again. But I need Karen's help to find him.
Gareth began to laugh, a deep rumbling sound that was more menacing than humorous.
Very well, young wolf. I will strike a bargain with you. I will help you recover your maiden, but you will make a promise to me as well. I know very well that once you have secured the woman, your father will forbid you to return. The dragons are important to him, but not worth the risk of his son's life. Swear to me that you will defy his will and go back for your dragon. Do that, and I will forgive your father's offence against my wife, whether you succeed or die in the attempt.
Matt smiled. That's an easy price. I would have done it anyway. If that is true, then I have no reservations in helping you get your girl, said Gareth.
Either way, my purpose will be served. Either a dragon is saved, or your arrogant father will get his comeuppance, losing his eldest son for treating my wife as his slave.
He smiled.
but there was no warmth in it. Chapter 31 Gareth promised to return the following morning. Next, Matthew planned to ask for Elaine Prathion's assistance, figuring her special abilities might come in handy should things turn out for the worse. But first, he had to face his father. The Count was waiting for him when he left the false family apartments and returned to their semi-secret home in the mountains. He was pacing in the entry hall, visibly agitated.
"Dad," started Matthew.
"Did he agree to help you?"
His voice was curious.
"Yes, but..."
Mordecai smiled.
"Excellent. That was quick thinking. I'm proud of you, son."
Matthew paused.
"Wait, you aren't mad?"
"Ha! Your mother thinks I'm a bad actor, but I've got news for you. I can bluff with the best of them. No, I'm not mad. When you decided to try and talk to him alone, I figured you wanted to try to get around his anger with me by negotiating separately. You caught me by surprise, but I figured it would work better if he thought you had made me angry. It may even have tipped the balance, letting him feel like he was getting back at me by helping you,"
explained Mordecai. He didn't think his father would have been as pleased if he had heard about the bargain at the end. Being ordered to stay safe at home after getting Karen back, he should have anticipated that. Even so, he knew he would have ignored the command, so he still didn't consider the bargain a betrayal. It just happened to align with what he would have done anyway.
"Well, I'm glad our plan worked,"
put in Matthew.
Mordecai looked at him, his eyes twinkling with mirth. "Plan my arse! You thought I was genuinely angry. I bet I scared the piss out of you when I slammed that door."
That was unfair. He'd been anxious, but he had never been one to shy away from an argument.
"I was a little worried," said Matthew defensively. "But that was all."
His father winked at him.
"Either way, that took balls, especially if you didn't know I was just playing along. You're quite the young rebel, aren't you?"
"I wasn't trying to be rebellious," he protested. He had always thought teenage rebellion for its own sake was rather stupid, and he hated being stereotyped that way. "I was just—"
"Oh, no," interrupted Mordecai. "You were definitely rebelling, which is why I have to punish you."
"What? But you just said you thought it was a good idea."
"There's a pile of dishes in the kitchen," his father informed him. "And I already gave Alyssa the day off."
Matt glared at him.
"You just didn't want to do them yourself," he grumbled.
"You'd best hurry, young hero. Every quest starts with an onerous task, and yours lies in the kitchen."
Elaine Prathion stood beside him in the transfer house, waiting on Gareth's arrival. She wore a plain woolen dress that was fairly practical by her standards, lacking extra embroidery or decoration, though it was dyed a deep crimson. Despite its simplicity, the dress was well-tailored, showcasing her figure. Matthew might have preferred it if she had worn trousers, given the dangers of their task, but Elaine would only make so many concessions when it came to hiding her femininity.
"Somehow I thought he would be the first one here," she said.
Matthew considered it for a moment. He had thought the same thing, but now he wondered.
"Well, he is 1,000 years old, and most of that time he was a dragon. Maybe his sense of time is a little eccentric."
She chuckled.
"That's a kind word for him. He's almost as scary as your father."
"Scary? Dad?" Matthew had trouble imagining that. If anything, Gareth was far more intimidating.
"Maybe it's because he's your father, but he was my teacher. Not to mention, the first time I met him, he was fighting Celior."
He guessed seeing something like that might have an effect on someone. For himself, he had missed seeing almost all of his father's legendary battles. Some had happened before he was born, and for those that came later, he and Moira had usually been ushered to safety. Growing up, he had always thought his dad was pretty amazing, but in part it was because everyone else seemed to believe it. The reality he lived with was an older man who stopped pretending to be an adult the moment he was out of the public view. Matthew nodded.
"I'll share the truth for you, then. He's a complete klutz. He's never met a wall or a piece of furniture he couldn't run into or trip over. When he isn't busy falling down, he acts like a randy teenager around my mother. If he didn't shield himself constantly, she'd have beaten him black and blue by now. It's really embarrassing.
He also has a habit of wandering around the house in his underclothes, and that's if you're lucky. Elaine giggled.
I guess our homes are more alike than I realized.
Some things cannot be unseen, agreed Matthew in mock horror. It was then that Gareth Galen appeared within the teleportation circle. He eyed them before speaking.
I hope that you two will be able to take this seriously. This isn't a summer outing.
Elaine lifted her chin and graced him with a smile.
Not to worry, Lord Galen. I'm certain we will both be doing our best when we arrive.
The older wizard ignored her reply and turned his eyes to Matthew. Where will we be leaving from?
Right here is fine, he replied. I should warn you both, though. I can't predict exactly where we'll arrive in the other world. I left a circle near Karen, so once we get there I'll need to make another so we can get to her location.
This should be easy, then, observed Elaine,
as long as we don't appear in the middle of your enemies.
Or the ocean, added Gareth.
That's happened to me once already, he admitted, before continuing. I also need to introduce you to the fourth member of our team.
He held the PM out in front of him, with the screen facing in their direction.
Gary, introduce yourself.
The screen lit, and a face appeared. Good morning, everyone. Both of the other wizards frowned, and Matthew could sense their focus on the PM. They were examining it, not only with their mage sight, but more actively with faint Aethar probes.
How is it talking?
Wondered Elaine out loud. Gareth squinted.
There's no magic in it, and I sensed nothing from him either.
By him, he obviously meant Matthew. If they hadn't been both mages, they might have been awed by the sight of such strange technology. But they were used to seeing unusual things. They only wanted to know how it worked.
He's Karen's virtual father, said Matthew. Similar to your wife, Lord Galen, but without using Aethar.
The term thinking machine might be easier to understand, suggested Gary.
How does it know our language? Asked Gareth.
While Matthew was learning our language, English, I also kept close notes of his usage of his native tongue.
You call your language Barian, correct?
They nodded.
Since I've been here, I've had a lot of time and opportunity to listen to your language. Some of the syntax and colloquialisms still confuse me, but I believe I have a grasp of at least 80% of it now. That will improve dramatically when we return to my world, and I can upload the data I've collected to my larger self. I'll be able to integrate the information much more quickly then.
Elaine and Gareth simply stared at the device in Matthew's hand, trying to sort through what it had said. The language had been Barian, but the usage and vocabulary had been put together in ways that were unfamiliar. Matthew cut in.
He has a strange way of speaking, since he isn't used to our language yet.
Gareth snapped out of it first.
Will it be useful to us?
Very,
assured the young man.
Gary made an observation in English. He's rather rude, isn't he?
Matthew replied in the same tongue.
He's a practical man. Do your best to stay on his good side. He's the one that can heal Karen.
Noted, said the AGI. Elaine was frowning as they spoke, but said nothing. Gareth showed no such restraint.
Stick to our language. I don't like being in the dark.
It took a few minutes longer, but eventually Matthew finished the explanations, and they were ready to leave. Elaine and Gareth stood on either side of him. She took his left hand, and Gareth rested his hand on Matt's shoulder. The world blurred, and they fell into the timeless abyss between worlds. A light blinked on Aesman's desk. Nodding and issuing a mental command, he accepted the channel. The face of Major General Gardner appeared across the desk from him.
"We have a signal," said Gardner.
"Where?"
"In Honduras."
Aesman nodded.
"Resolution?"
"Less than a mile, Director,"
reported the General.
"It's very close to a place that used to be known as Dulsuna."
"That's good," commented the Director.
"ANSYS has improved our accuracy by a factor of at least 10.
As we get more signals and data, we should be able to do even better," agreed the General.
"How long before we can respond?" asked Aesman.
"It's 7 minutes for the nearest missile assets, Director. 18 minutes for air support, and 25 if you want units on the ground," reported Gardner succinctly.
The Director paused, thinking for several long seconds. The plan was to respond with an immediate missile strike if the response time was 5 minutes or less. Seven was close, but not close enough.
Send in drones and air support. Get the armor on the move. I don't think they'll reach the area in time, but it's best to be sure. We'll have to hope they move as we expect.
He glanced toward the ceiling of his virtual office, as though wondering if an invisible god were listening in.
I didn't say too much, he thought.
You have your orders, General. We'll speak again in 10 minutes, commanded Aisman, cutting the link.
I can't even say something as simple as secure channels, he thought sourly.
With a sigh, he rose from his desk and prepared to send himself to the Gulf Coast UN cybernetics facility. He hated being forced to download into a physical body, but if their suspicions were correct, it was the only way to avoid having their communications intercepted. He would meet General Gardner and Deputy Director Wong there, where they could coordinate their ANSYS assets directly, without relying on the network. He could only hope that Dr. Miller wouldn't decide to join them. Chapter 32 Matthew was almost used to the disorientation that always came after shifting, but it was the first time for Elaine and Gareth. The former looked decidedly green as she swayed on her feet, while Gareth unceremoniously bent over and vomited onto the ground. Elaine jumped back, hoping to avoid letting vomit land on her shoes or the hem of her dress, but the sudden movement almost made her lose control of her own stomach. Matt ignored them both, taking a couple of casual steps away and using his power to clean his boots while he waited for them to regain their composure. Scanning the area, he was struck by its beauty. The landscape was dominated by rolling hills with larger mountains on the horizon. Their immediate vicinity was a verdant grassland, but there was a heavily forested area within a half mile of them to the north. Gazing south, he saw signs of more forest there. Gary spoke almost before Matt could finish looking around.
We have trouble. The military is already moving. They know your location.
That was fast, observed Matthew.
Are you sure?
They've grown very cautious. They've stopped communicating through military network channels. Most of their leadership is convening in cybernetic units in North America, said Karen's virtual father.
You'll have to explain what that means, said Matthew.
He was still coming to terms with the broader implications of the world's technology.
It means they suspect I have infiltrated military encrypted channels. They're going to the trouble to download into cybernetic bodies for their meetings in order to avoid me overhearing them. It also means they expect that what they are saying on secure channels will reach me, so we have to assume that what I have learned may be deliberate misinformation, said the AGI.
So, they're paranoid, said Matt. What do you think they're doing?
They may have missiles in the air already. If so, this area will be obliterated in less than 5 minutes. The best-case scenario is that they were telling the truth, in which case drones and other offensive air capabilities will be here in around 15 minutes, reported Gary.
Shit, swore Matthew. Why does everything happen so quickly in this world?
He didn't wait for an answer, though. There wasn't time. Using his Aethar to direct the soil beneath him, he cleared a 5-foot by 5-foot area and started drawing a circle.
4 or 5 minutes wasn't long.
Elaine stepped closer.
Are we in that much of a hurry?
He nodded, too busy to bother talking. She could see the concentration on his face, and that was all the answer she needed. Drawing out one of her wands, she poked him with it to get his attention.
I'll do the outer and inner geometries. I'm faster. You focus on the runes and the keys, since I don't know them.
Matt stared at her for a second.
Good idea.
She was already beginning the outer ring, so he started inscribing the runes that went between it and the inner ring, trusting her to complete the lines that would enclose them. Gary spoke again.
I should also warn you that they have something else planned. They're expecting you to move if they don't hit this location quickly enough, and they think they have an idea of where you will go. As far as I can estimate, that means they suspect you will either try to reach the egg or return to get Karen.
Matthew heard him, but he was too focused on his work to reply. Somewhere in the back of his head, though, he tried to assimilate the new warning. Meanwhile, Gareth was still having trouble adjusting to the new world. The older man's nausea had subsided, but he was deeply affected by the complete lack of ambient aether. He continually turned his head, first one way and then the other, as though he were listening for something.
"I don't understand,"
he muttered to himself. Seconds ticked by as Gary continued, trying to share as much information as he could before they teleported.
"While you were gone, I did manage to locate the Dragon Egg's precise location, but since it is within the CC Center in England, I can guarantee that it is heavily guarded. As far as Karen's location, I estimate a very high chance they have found her. While all military assets are disconnected from the network, I have analyzed recent satellite imagery and found evidence of an unusual amount of men and materials being moved in the region."
"It's as though the world is dead," said Gareth, still talking to himself. "There's nothing. It's just silence."
Elaine finished the larger portion of the teleportation circle and stepped back.
"It's just your part now, Matthew."
Matt felt sweat forming on his brow as he worked. This last part couldn't be rushed. Every rune had to be correct. He could feel Elaine's eyes on him as he progressed, and Gareth was still mumbling in the background.
"What's that?"
she said suddenly, looking at the sky and shading her eyes with one hand.
"I don't hear anything,"
Gareth said to them, as though emphasizing some point they should already be aware of. Gary misunderstood his remark, though, thinking he referred to what Elaine was seeing.
"You don't hear them because they travel at hypersonic velocities, Mach 5 to be specific. You'll be dead before the sound gets here."
"Done,"
announced Matthew. "Step inside the circle, quickly."
"What were you saying, Gary? I couldn't pay full attention."
"I think they're waiting for you," summarized the AGI. Elaine had her hand on his forearm already as Gareth took his final step into the teleportation circle. He put his hand on Matthew's shoulder. Physical contact wasn't really necessary as long as they were inside the lines, but it communicated their readiness more quickly than words.
"Make us invisible," ordered Matthew.
He waited another second while Elaine did so, and then he activated the circle. They arrived in darkness, courtesy of Elaine's invisibility shield. It was one of the main drawbacks to invisibility. Since it routed all light around the user, it meant being effectively blind. She hadn't blocked Aethar, though. In a world without mages, they didn't have to worry about being spotted by someone with mage sight, so they could still see a short distance using their arcane senses. Unfortunately, due to the relative paucity of Aethar, that meant they couldn't sense much of anything beyond about 20 to 30 feet. Even so, Matthew immediately knew something was wrong. The one thing that should have been very visible in such a low Aethar environment was the stasis field he had left behind. It wasn't there. Then the world exploded around them. Matthew's shield held, but Elaine was surprised enough that she lost her grip on the veil she had around them. Light flooded in, showing them a world of flames and dust. While the explosion had caused the ground to jump beneath them, it was eerily silent, thanks to Matthew deciding to block sound as well as physical attacks. He had learned his lesson regarding that back at Roberta's house. "They were definitely waiting for us," said Gary, stating the obvious.
"We're exposed, girl," shouted Gareth. "Let me out and I'll distract them while you find the woman."
He was already moving, so Matthew opened the shield to let him pass and then closed it again. Elaine covered them with her invisibility veil once more, and he pulled on her arm, making sure she stayed close to him as he headed in the direction of where the stasis enchantment had been. Gareth's body flowed like water as he passed beyond the shield, reforming into something distinctly reptilian. He looked like no animal Matt had ever seen, as the archmage dropped on all fours and sped forward, metallic scales gleaming silver in the sunlight. Their position couldn't have been worse. Being at the bottom of the canyon, their enemy had taken up positions along the rim thousands of feet above. They were probably on the other side as well, but that was too far for Matt to tell. In the immediate vicinity there was a variety of small groups, consisting of 3 or 4 cybernetic soldiers equipped with automatic rifles and grenade launchers. While the invisibility shield had been down, Matthew thought he had seen larger vehicles in the distance, but now that he was once again limited to the short range of his mage sight, he couldn't be sure. He kept walking toward where he had left Karen. The creature that Gareth had become moved with frightening speed. It raced across the distance to the nearest soldiers and proceeded to rip them mechanical limb from mechanical limb. Weapons fire rang out from every direction, but it had little effect on his heavily armored body. His speed took the soldiers by surprise,
and once he had reached the first group, they had to take care not to use their heavier weapons for fear of destroying each other. Gareth had no such constraints, though. He destroyed everything within reach, and after he had dismantled the first group, he sprang toward the next. As Gareth ran for the second group, they began firing heavier weapons, and while some of the shots glanced off, others hit him squarely, exploding on impact and tearing large chunks of flesh from his massive form. It slowed him down, but other than that, it didn't do them much good. His flesh flowed and reformed whenever he took a substantial injury, even replacing a lost limb from a blast that had sent him sprawling into the dust. Then he was on the second group. Matthew and Elaine had a much easier task, since the enemy seemed to be focusing their efforts on the foe they could see, rather than the one they couldn't. However, after travelling only 20 feet, they were struck again by another explosion, one that came from beneath them. Matthew nearly lost his shield, and Elaine's veil flickered again. "That was an anti-personnel mine, I think," noted Gary. "Mine?" said Matthew, in confusion. "A bomb in the ground," explained the AGI. "They anticipated you would try to reach the place you left her, so they've set it up to kill you when you do. There are probably more of them close by." As if to punctuate his point, Gareth was tossed into the air by a similar explosion as he headed for the third group of soldiers. The blast sent blood and flesh flying in various directions, but the core of his body reformed as it twisted through the air, sprouting wings that assisted him in regaining control of his movement. The monstrous archmage dove for the soldiers.
"This is madness," shouted Elaine.
"I agree," said Gary. "I also estimate a very low probability that my daughter is still here. If she is alive at all, they likely moved her to a secure location before setting this trap for us."
"All right, let's retreat," said Matthew.
"Elaine, switch to the exit plan." They began heading in Gareth's direction.
"Gareth, we're leaving," he yelled mentally.
The reptilian monster changed direction mid-charge, which turned out to be a fortuitous choice, as the terrain he was about to cross vanished in a massive explosion a second later. If he had continued in the direction he had been going, he would have been in the middle of it. At the same time, four identical copies of Gareth's form appeared, and began charging in different directions. More explosions erupted from two of their locations, and the entire area was cloaked in a cloud of smoke and dust. Elaine added to it by augmenting the smoke with an even larger illusory cloud.
"What are they firing at us now?" asked Matthew. "Are those missiles?"
"I believe it's artillery fire from the canyon rim," said Gary. "Your friend must have scared them enough to call a strike on their own position. We should leave now. They may decide not to wait for the smoke to clear before they carpet bomb the entire zone." Gareth reached them, and after Matthew let him through their shield, he immediately began to shift back home. They landed in the ocean, which seemed appropriate, considering the luck they had had thus far. Matthew created a stable platform beneath them, and brought out the enchanted cubes that would enable him to fly and safely carry them all together. Gareth didn't seem to be in any condition to shift into a large flying form. The red-bearded wizard lay quietly in the mostly invisible flying construct, staring up at the sky.
"I have never seen such a swift and vicious response," he muttered. "Those people are not novices when it comes to war."
Whatever injuries he had sustained had vanished even before he had returned to his human form, but he still seemed shaken by the experience.
"That's how they defeated the Shi'ar," Matthew informed him.
"That's also probably why the Shi'ar almost lost when they first came to our world. The humans here just weren't quite as advanced and prepared for them."
"If that's the case, then I think perhaps humanity is more frightening than the Shi'ar," said the Archmage.
Elaine was still in shock from what she had seen.
"Can all Galen mages shift the way you did? I've never seen anything quite like that. It was amazing."
Gareth chuckled, tiredly.
"All Galen mages can shift forms, yes, but what I was doing is far from normal. In the old days, some of the really talented people in my family could have done some of what you saw, but the near-instant healing is an Archmage ability."
"I don't think my father could do that," commented Matt. "The shifting, probably not, but he's transformed into a giant of earth and stone and healed himself in that form," said Gareth.
"It's basically the same thing. He just doesn't have my affinity for taking living forms. I wouldn't dream of turning myself into something inanimate like he did. It's too easy to lose yourself that way." They fell silent for a time after that, while Matthew flew them westward, hoping to catch sight of land so they could stop and create a teleportation circle. Gareth seemed to doze for a while, but then he spoke without opening his eyes. "Young Wolf." Elaine and Matthew looked at one another, and then he answered, "Sir?" "I take back what I said the other day. I was in a foul mood. That world is a death trap. Forget about the dragon. Forget the girl as well. No good can come of returning," said the older man. Matt's lips pressed together in a firm line, but as he was about to reply, the Archmage spoke again. "Don't say it, boy. If you tell me you're planning to return, I'll inform your father and make sure he finds some way to lock you up for your own good. If you're a man, keep your own counsel. I won't be going back, and if you say otherwise, I'll make sure you can't either." Elaine gave him a sympathetic look. "I'm still willing—" "The same goes for you, girl," Gareth said, cutting her off. They flew in silence from that point onward. It was several hours before they spotted an island off an unnamed coast. None of them recognized the area. Tired, they landed and made a circle to take them back to Castle Cameron. Once there, Gareth bid them goodbye and left without another word.
"He's a strange man," observed Elaine.
"Yeah," agreed Matthew. "I think he knows I'm planning to go back, though. He just doesn't want to be responsible for it. That's why he told us not to talk about it." She frowned.
"That makes no sense."
"He's from another time," said Matt. "He's also a big believer in free will, which probably is at cross purposes with his opinion that we're too young to put ourselves deliberately into danger."
"Speak for yourself," said Elaine. "I'm a grown woman."
"Fine," sighed Matthew. "Just me, then. I'm barely an adult by their standards." She smiled.
"I meant what I said. If I can help, I will."
Gary spoke for the first time since they had returned. "Take her up on the offer."
"Hm?"
"I intercepted some of their short-range transmissions while you were fighting, and I was able to analyze what their sensors reported during the battle. Her invisibility is far more effective than I had anticipated. I assumed initially that thermal imaging would still detect you, since she can't see it herself to ensure that infrared light is included. But I was wrong."
"Thanks for the warning," said Matt dryly.
"You could have told me that you thought their devices might still be able to see us." "While we were here, I had incomplete data," Gary explained. "I had no expectation we would be walking into a trap, so I didn't think it was pertinent."
"Plus, it's your daughter," added Matthew. "You didn't want to say anything that might have made us change our minds."
Gary paused. "There is some truth there." Matthew took a deep breath. "I have no intention of giving up on either Karen or Desiccus's egg. So you can put that concern aside. From now on, tell me whatever you know. I can't plan for things I'm not aware of."
"Then you'll be glad to know I have a suggestion for getting Karen back," said the AGI.
"Do you think we'll need Gareth for it to work?" asked Elaine.
"No," answered Gary. "If things go right, you won't have to fight anyone at all. But your special talent will be a necessity."
They began planning in earnest, and once they had a workable idea, they agreed to meet again the next morning.
Chapter 33 That evening Matthew told his parents how their journey had gone. They were understandably worried, of course, but he only told them that Karen had been moved. He completely omitted the fact that they had been targeted from the beginning, that they had teleported into a trap, and that they had been forced to beat a hasty retreat to avoid being annihilated. Since Gareth Galen wasn't on good terms with his father, Matt didn't expect that he would be contradicted on his account, and Elaine had agreed to give the same details if she should be questioned. As a result of his deception, his father was still willing to allow him to return to get Karen. His mother had been of a different mind on the matter, but after a fierce debate, she decided to allow it as well. Unexpectedly, it was Graham who raised the biggest objection when they met at the Muddy Pig later. They had both eaten already, so they were there just to share a mug of ale and catch up.
After hearing Matthew's tale, the unedited version, Graham became concerned.
"You need to bring me when you go back," he said firmly.
Matthew winced.
"Ordinarily I would say yes, but not this time."
Graham looked angry.
"Why not?"
Matthew held up his dimensional pouch.
"This doesn't work over there. As cool as it is, it only works when it's in this world. Otherwise the connection to the pocket dimension doesn't function properly."
With his finger, he pointed at the tattoo on Graham's arm.
"This enchantment is slightly different, but it works on the same fundamental magic. You won't be able to summon Thorn. You won't be able to summon your armor."
"Then I won't summon them there," countered Graham.
"I can arm and armor myself before we go."
Matt shook his head.
"There are still problems. If we're there for an extended period, you couldn't take the armor off. Then there's your father's heart, the gem that gives you your strength. It's empowered by your father's earth bond. I guarantee you that won't work across dimensions, and taking it away from this plane might even destroy it. I can borrow Sakaian's armor. It's not a perfect fit for me, but it's close enough," countered Graham. "And I don't have to use Thorn. There are other enchanted swords."
"And you'll fight as a normal man?" asked Matthew.
"I have a dragon bond too. Desiccus died, Graham. The same could happen to Grace, and then we'd have two eggs to recover. Besides, I'm not planning to fight my way through. It's just not possible. They've shown me that every time. The people of that world have the capability to coordinate their forces on a scale we simply can't compete with, and they have weapons that can destroy anyone or anything, as long as they're willing to accept the collateral damage. You're my best friend, and there's no one I trust more, but I'm not taking you into a place like that for no good reason. This will be a stealth mission. There are only three people really suited to that: Elaine, George, or their father Walter. Honestly, even I am not an ideal choice, but I'm the only one who can get there," Matthew explained.
Graham vented his frustration in a growl that ended with him slamming his mug down on the table. Heads around the room turned in their direction.
"This isn't fair, damn it," swore the young knight. "I want to break something, but I know you're right."
After a moment, when it was evident the young warrior wasn't about to start dismantling the tavern, the eyes around the room returned to their own drinks. Matthew was glad for that. He didn't enjoy being at the center of attention.
"I'm sorry, Graham. That's just the way it is," he answered apologetically.
Back in his room, Matthew was restless, and Gary, while trying to be helpful, wasn't making it any easier for him to relax and get some sleep.
"Before we left, I received a lot of information from my larger self," said the AGI.
"You already told me you had the probable location of Charon and Desiccus," said Matt.
"Locations plural," corrected Gary. "Charon's in the UN's Gulf Coast facility. That's definite. I actually saw her being taken in there on non-military surveillance video."
"At least she's alive."
"That's a positive," agreed Charon's virtual father. "Her condition is easily treatable with modern medicine. My biggest concern is what her mother may do to her."
"Surely she wouldn't hurt her."
"Don't put it past her. She doesn't even think of Charon as her child. My creator was rather biased regarding Tanya's limits, but I have the advantage of a more objective viewpoint. She's capable of anything. If she believes she can learn something by dissecting Charon's brain, she'll do it. It hasn't been long, though, and Tanya isn't one to be impatient, so we probably still have time."
Matthew shuddered.
"That's horrible."
"It is," said Gary. "But it's who she is."
"The problem," began Matt, "is that we don't have a way of reaching that place. I've never been there, and there's no teleportation circle handy to get us there. As soon as we cross over, they'll know our location. Even with Elaine to hide us, we couldn't get far enough to avoid the missiles they're liable to send at us."
"I can handle that," began the AGI, but a knock on the door interrupted him.
"Go away!"
shouted Matthew.
His magesite had already informed him that it was his younger brother Connell at the door. The door opened.
"I knew I should have put a lock on the door," grumbled Matthew.
"I'm busy, Connell. Leave me alone."
"I've hardly seen you since you got back," whined his brother.
"And it's been lovely,"
replied Matthew sarcastically.
"I want to help," announced Connell. "I'll let you know the next time they decide I have to do the dishes. You know what I mean. My power awoke while you were gone. I can do things now. I could help you,"
insisted his brother. Several cutting remarks passed through Matthew's head before he discarded them as too harsh. Giving his brother a grave look, he answered more seriously,
"How old are you now? 13? 14,
Connell shot back.
"You can't even keep up with my birthdays."
"Oh, 14, yeah, I'm sorry. That's a much more mature age. Since you're so much older now, I should be honest with you." Connell nodded. Matthew walked across the room and tapped a portion of the wall next to the door. "Do you see this spot right here?"
"Yeah."
"All right. Remember that spot. It will be important later. Now, let's say I let you come with me. You already know this will be incredibly dangerous, and I'd be taking the risk of losing my favorite brother." He tried his best to keep the sarcasm out of his voice, but he doubted he was entirely successful. Connell smiled.
"What an idiot,"
thought Matt.
"But here's the real problem. Suppose we succeed. Let's imagine we make it back safe and sound. We're heroes, and nothing terrible happens to you during this adventure. What do you think will happen?"
His younger brother gave it serious thought for a moment before answering,
"They'll have a celebration, maybe a feast."
Matthew shook his head sadly.
"No. Well, they might, but something far worse would happen first."
He tapped the spot on the wall again.
"Mum and Dad would lose their minds over the fact that I had taken you with me. After surviving untold dangers, I'd return home only to have them cut my balls off and hang them on the wall, probably in this very spot, or at least one very similar to it."
Connell looked glum.
"Oh. Now get out so I can go back to not sleeping," finished Matt, pointing at the door.
His brother headed for the door, but stopped to look back.
Matt?
"What?"
"I'm not stupid. I'm your only brother, so I kind of have to be your favorite."
Matthew gave him an evil grin.
"Unless Mom and Dad have another boy. There's still hope for the future. You should enjoy the position now, before my new favorite brother arrives."
Connell stuck out his tongue, then shut the door. "You're a terrible brother," commented Gary. "Do you treat all your siblings that way?"
"Just the ones that bother me," said the young wizard.
"Define bother." "If they're in here or in my workshop, they're bothering me," clarified Matthew.
"Or if I'm reading. But I usually do that in one of those places, since they don't seem to recognize the fact that I have a book in my hand."
"You sound like a joy to be around," noted Gary dryly.
"Don't worry, it's just a phase I'm going through."
The AGI's expression was doubtful.
"You think so?"
"No. But it makes everyone feel better when I say that."
"Do you feel better now?" asked Matthew.
Gary sighed. "I can never tell if you're joking or serious." Matthew lifted one brow enigmatically, but didn't answer.
"No, honestly, I'd like to know."
"Just always assume I'm serious and you'll be fine. My humor is not for the faint of heart," Matt advised him in a flat tone. Gary was exasperated.
"Now I know you're joking."
"Am I?" "I'm going to ignore that," said the machine. "Back to what we were discussing. Next time we cross over, I think I can get us where we need to go, assuming we can get far enough away from our entry point to avoid being blown to pieces."
Matthew leaned closer. "I'm listening."
Chapter 34 The next morning, Matthew and Elaine shifted again, and, as they had the last time, found themselves falling into the ocean.
"Does it always have to be the ocean?" complained Elaine, as she stood on a hastily solidified platform of water.
Matthew was scanning the horizon, so it was Gary who answered first. "Roughly 70% of the surface is ocean. Since our arrival point is apparently random, it's to be expected that we will appear over sea most of the time."
"How long do we have?"
asked Matthew, as he arranged the enchanted cubes that would form his flying construct. "They didn't even have a meeting this time," the AGI informed them.
But since all the principal members of the defense leadership have begun downloading into cybernetic bodies, I assume they have detected our arrival. Based on our distance from the nearest military assets, I estimate we have 12 minutes. Without any landmass at this location, they will be forced to scramble interceptors